The following program is a production of the Evergreen Radio Reading Service, a part of the Washington Talking Book and Braille Library, based in Seattle.
This is Joe Henderson, and I am the host of The Kitchen Corner. And as you know, periodically, we are graced with the company of cookbook authors who are in town and spend a few minutes with us talking about their latest books, recipes, and other kinds of discussions and philosophies. And today, we have with us Annie Pio. Annie is the author. Her latest book is Annie's Raw Food Asia, Easy East to West Fusion Recipes. But this is not her first, and I'm going to let Annie's voice introduce you to herself and tell you a little bit more about the type of food that she does and the books that she's written before. Welcome to The Kitchen Corner, Annie.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
It's good to have you. So tell us a little bit about some of the work that you do and the type of foods that you are involved with, because raw food, I might have heard about the raw food movement maybe 10 years ago, and it seemed totally unrealistic to me that someone could eat only raw foods. Since then, I gather that there are a number of other people who have gotten involved, and you are very well recognized for having been much of a pioneer and caterer in this business. So tell us about the work that you do and tell us something about the prior books that led to this one.
Yeah, I feel, I think today it's becoming much more mainstream. I think because people are now beginning to make a connection between the food we eat and our level of health and well-being, which is really great. I think raw food's been around forever. My father was actually a raw fooder for health reasons, and he raised me that way. So we had our organic garden. My mom and I would go out to the garden every morning and pick whatever fruits, vegetables were ripe. We did have fruit trees as well, like apple and pear. Mm-hmm. But we'd pick vegetables, and she would just put them through a juicer. So I always tell the story of being tortured as a child. We would eat mud sludge, disgusting, like green, thick vegetable juices every morning. So I was raised on that. So it's as an adult, I sort of came back around full circle to it's basically the idea of whole foods, ideally local, ideally organic. Mm-hmm. It's just decreasing processed foods in our diet, taking out a lot of the toxic chemical preservatives, artificial coloring, artificial flavoring, high sodium, all of these artificial poisons that over time accumulate in our body to create chronic illness and disease. So over a long time, it just builds up and then creates, you know, hypertension, heart disease, even cancer at mm-hmm. the extreme. Mm-hmm. So it's about clean food. So I started my business of raw food probably around the mid to late 90s. Mm-hmm. And it started as an event and catering company. So we did lots of like dinner events on the weekends. We did brunch. And then that sort of went into a line of prepared packaged foods, which then eventually became a line of fruit and nut bars in the early days of bars. Right. Now there's a whole bunch of bars. So my first book was called Annie's Raw Food Kitchen. The second one is called Annie's Raw Food Desserts. The third one's called Annie's Raw Food Essentials. And then the new one's Annie's Raw Food Asia. So we can see it's like a series of Annie's mm-hmm. raw food. So
and progression.
A progression.
But you didn't always eat this way. And so there's something that led you back to, again, eating the way you had been raised and the way that your parents taught you. And I should say that both of your parents are Korean immigrants. So were you born in the United States or did you come as a young child? And was it difficult to make that transition from the farm life in Korea to America?
I was actually born in Canada.
Okay.
I was born in Nova Scotia.
Okay.
And then we moved to the States probably like around when I was one or two.
Okay.
So I've been in the States most of my life and that was naturalized through my parents. So I'm a U.S. citizen. It was a difficult childhood, I think, because, you know, we lived in the mountains where we had a lot of land, we lived in nature, we had an organic garden. I think that there were no other people of color in those areas. Mm-hmm. Definitely not in the mountains.
Outside of New York. Okay.
Above New York City in the Catskills.
Okay, you spoke about Tennessee in your book.
So I think from Canada, we moved to Minneapolis.
Okay.
And then that's where my brother was born. And then we moved to Tennessee. And then my dad was a student, so we moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Tennessee, then we moved to New York State. Mm-hmm. And we moved around a lot in New York State. So I think from Tennessee, we moved to the Catskill Mountains. And then from there, we moved to like Fredonia. And then we moved up towards Buffalo. So we moved around a lot within New York State. But we lived about 5 or 6 years in the Catskill Mountains.
And did he farm in all of those various communities?
We had, the farm was mostly in the Catskill Mountain ones.
Mm-hmm.
We had little, you know, we would grow little things potted or have smaller little gardens, but nothing like in the Catskills because we had a lot more land there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always weird because as a child, in my lunchbox, it would always be like, you know, vegetables and wraps. And, you know, I just wanted like those plastic packaged bright yellow cakes and chocolate
Lunchables.
Yeah, exactly. All that kind of stuff. You know,
with
I wanted cheese and lunch meat. I wanted what I thought was American food.
Of course.
And so that's what's so interesting as an adult now. Just recently, maybe in the last 5 or 6 years, I sort of just realized I went to Asia. I went and spent almost 2 months in Southeast Asia a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really realized that America media is really great at creating this image of what the rest of the world thinks America is, right? The Hollywood and everything. But, you know, the media that I see, it doesn't actually represent people that look like me or live like me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my friends actually live like me or like us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And none of that is on television. So I realized sort of, you know, the mainstream media is creating this image of an America that isn't my reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the people
who do look like us don't act like us.
Yeah.
Or live like we do.
Exactly. I know.
It is a little bit strange. It's surreal. If people could really understand that what they see on TV is an alternate universe.
Yeah.
You know,
it really
it's not. It's even their lives are not like what they see on TV.
Absolutely.
You know?
And it's also reinforcing that very much stereotype of middle America meat and potatoes. You know, or even on, you know, some of the food shows, I never understood. I mean, I'm not saying this, I don't even know if I should be saying this, but, you know, I never understood how people don't make a correlation between what we eat and our level of health, because a lot of the food show hosts are extremely overweight.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look healthy. They don't look vibrant. You know, they don't look like they exercise. They sure as heck don't eat healthy because they're showing us how to make food using like a whole pound of butter. They're deep frying stuff. They're using a ton of flour, a ton of like cholesterol laden ingredients, and they don't look healthy, you know, but yet we're watching these shows thinking, oh, I want to learn how to make that food. And then I'm going to make these recipes that this overweight, unhealthy chef is making. And they don't understand it.
Shame on you.
Yeah, they don't understand that if you eat that, you're going to look like that.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, too, I think that we have to make a correlation ourselves between the two of us. I'm a little bit overweight. Most people don't think that I am, but I know that I'm a bit overweight. When you stop to consider that 60% of the American public is either overweight or obese, what they see on TV represented on those food network chefs is really what they see in their own homes and around their neighborhoods. So it doesn't appear to them as if there is something wrong. And when all of the commercials on television are selling you the food that you're putting on your table, it seems normal. What you are doing is out of the norm. And what you are doing is trying to raise awareness, as a couple of the chefs out there are trying to do right
they
now.
They definitely are. Yeah.
But it's going to take us a while. It took us decades to get to where we are in America. It's going to take us that long, if not longer, to get back to something that's a little bit more healthy.
Absolutely.
And so, but this is a very good first start because when I looked at this book, I realized it's like, oh gosh, even though I eat a very healthy diet, I have an extremely long way to go, and I'm not even really sure I'm going to meet you at this place. but I do have some questions that I want to ask you, and you feel comfortable to talk about the things that are really important to you and what you want to get across to our listening audience. But it occurred to me when I was reading that this cookbook doesn't just introduce us to a way of eating, but it introduces us to a philosophy and a way around the cultivating and eating of raw fruits and vegetables. So can you explain a bit about the entire raw food movement? What makes that relevant for us, and especially for you as, I would say, a culinary gospel?
Absolutely. So in a nutshell, I just want to say the reason I write my books is to make Whole Foods accessible. My basic rule of thumb and what I want to encourage everyone to do is avoid food that has been created by a machine in a factory. That's processed food.
Oh, that means hot dogs.
Anything that a machine has made. Mm-hmm. If human hands haven't made that, if Mother Earth hasn't made it. Okay, so all I'm saying is look for food that comes straight from Mother Earth. That means fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds. If we do eat meat, I encourage people to choose organic grass-fed beef, perhaps bison, wild-caught fish that is low in mercury. You know, those things come straight from Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. If we instead have foods that have been created by machines in a factory, if we really think about the money that goes into buying that, mm-hmm. that food, what we're paying for is the labeling, the printing of that label, the labeling, the packaging, the manufacturing of that food, because somebody has to pay for all those machines, all those factories, and then a truck has to come and then pick that all up, ship it to a warehouse. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to pay for that warehouse, whether it's refrigerated, it's a lot of energy, they pay for that. And then from there, then it's taken, shipped again, more gasoline to a store where it sits on the shelf. For how long? A lot of times packaged foods sit indefinitely. Maybe their shelf life is a year or 2 years. That's why they use artificial flavor, artificial color, preservatives, because it sits around for so long. And then we go to the store and then we drive it home. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that equation, all the money that we're spending on that quote unquote food is actually going into that whole process. Mm-hmm. So there's very little margin left over for the actual ingredients. That's why they have to use chemicals. So if you look at a common juice, it's not actually fruit as the first ingredient. You know, they label it, you know, the first ingredient is what's most in there. It's usually water and sugar mm-hmm. and some kind of artificial color and some kind of artificial flavor. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at the end of that equation, they don't have money left over to use real fruit juice in there. Mm-hmm. So what I'm encouraging is instead, let's transfer those funds to go to a local farmer's market to support a local farmer, or go to a Whole Foods store and just buy the fruit or the vegetable unprocessed whole, because we're actually getting more nourishment, more nutrients, we're getting more for our money.
And it tastes better.
It tastes better. It's better for our health. So that's my basic premise. So I know that my books say raw food, but what I encourage people is that if it's cold out, or, you know, I always say when you're going to make something like a chili, make 3 batches. So you dirty everything once. You just rinse it out. It's cleanup is so fast and easy. So then you have 3 batches. You have leftovers. It's sitting in the fridge. Well, the fridge is cold. And so later in the day when I want to reach in there and pull out my leftovers, I might not want to eat it at fridge temperature. Mm-hmm. So if I want, then I'll heat it up in a saucepan. If I want to keep the temperature to about 104, which is about the barrier for raw food, mm-hmm. I'll put my finger in it. And when it becomes warm to the touch, then I'll take it off the stove. But if it's cold out and I'm craving something hot, I'll let it boil and I'll enjoy it that way, because it's still cleaner than something that I got from the store that mm-hmm. came out of a can or came out of a box. It's fresh and clean.
I'm glad you said that. That's you would let it boil, because I, when I was reading this book, nowhere in it, when I saw 104 degrees, it's like, okay, this is a little bit extreme and obsessive.
I have a range top. I have a range top icon in there. I have an
icon. Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Where I say you can heat this up.
You can heat it up.
Definitely.
But you give us permission to heat it up.
Absolutely.
But I didn't see where you said you heated anything up. So I was going to ask you, so you don't drink coffee, you don't drink tea. It was as if you had an aversion to anything above 104 degrees. That's not true.
No. And okay. I actually, my focus and the focus of this book, each book has a different focus. So mm-hmm. with Annie's Raw Food Kitchen, it was really about encouraging people to live green, mm-hmm. be more conscious of what we're putting on our bodies, reusing, reducing, you know, thinking about the environment, mm-hmm. clean water, clean air, all that kind of stuff. The second book, Annie's Raw Food Desserts, was focused on beauty and weight loss through eating healthy desserts, if you can believe that, right? Mm-hmm. So that my desserts are made out of nuts and seeds and fruit, so you can actually eat them and lose weight. And then the third book was Annie's Raw Food Essentials. I wanted to break the misconception that to be healthy, it needs to take a lot of time, cost a lot of money, or be difficult. Mm-hmm. And so my whole business has been built on making recipes that are so fast and easy and delicious that anybody can do it in like a snap. Mm-hmm. So with Annie's Raw Food Asia, that is, you know, I'm really focused on happiness and longevity. And the equation, I think, for happiness is that we decrease stress. Mm-hmm. And I was 100%, I claimed to be like 110% raw food or whatever that means for about eight, nine years. Mm-hmm. And it created so much stress for me because it's like, okay, is this cranberry dehydrated at 104? Chances are cranberry is probably dehydrated at 250 or 300. So it's actually technically not raw. Or if this olive oil is pressed, it actually creates heat. Oh no, it's not centrifuged. So I just let all that go, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So
I did read that as it got to the tail end of the book, you know, it was sort of like, this was creating stress in my life. And
exactly.
So I've kind of like lightened up a little bit. But I must tell you, as I was walking through the book, it kind of raised my anxiety level a little bit because there were all of these new terms that you had to become familiar with. There are all of these foods that are not familiar to me, especially a lot of stuff out of the sea that I was
vegetables.
Not familiar with. I've heard of sea beans, but there's a whole host of sea vegetables out there beyond just sea beans and sea cucumbers. There was something called maca,
which is a wonderful adaptogen.
Yeah.
These are all just superfoods. So I think superfoods are slowly breaking more into the mainstream too.
Can I stop you right there and ask you, that was going to be one of my questions. There are terms in the book that I think the listeners need to have explained. And so maybe they overlap or interchange with each other, but I'd really like to have you give us an idea of what is a whole food, what is a superfood, what is a living food? You know, what are all of these various food categories that you talk about?
So whole food, basically, like I said earlier, is something that comes straight from Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Whole food in its whole natural state and form. Hasn't been manipulated by a machine in a factory.
Mm-hmm.
So a fruit, a nut, a seed, a vegetable, or, you know, a piece of wild-caught salmon, something like that is a whole food. It hasn't been manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, that is organic. Living food, raw food, living food, people use that interchangeably. I actually see it as being a little bit different. Raw food, so for me, the way that I define raw food is that it's just clean food that comes straight from Mother Earth that hasn't been manipulated. It's sort of like using raw stones to build a stone house. It's like raw materials. So that's how I sort of call it. There's also a temperature limit assigned to that. And so that's, for me, that's 104. There's really no standard. Some people go up to 116. It's what we believe beyond which there's been scientific research done, and everyone can search that online. The more heat that we apply to a food, it damages the nutritional value and it lowers it. So when we heat food more, also it softens the fiber. We need fiber in food to sweep through our system. It's naturally detoxifying and cleansing like a broom.
Mm-hmm.
And then also when we heat something, it loses its water because the steam rises off of that food. Well, we're made of like 80% water.
Mm-hmm.
And the best water we can get is structured water that's been structured and cleaned by the fruit or the vegetable. You know, it pulls up all this mineralized water from the soil and then deposits it in the fruit or vegetable. So if we heat it up, then we're losing a lot of that water, which means we then have to drink it out of bottled water, which just isn't as valuable, you know? So, so that's raw food. And then living food is this idea that, it's sort of interesting, but with raw food or living food, if we take anything that's left over or any food product, so if I take a wrap that I made, that's a lettuce wrap with some shredded carrots and cucumber and a sauce maybe that I've made with blended miso and maybe a little bit of sweetener and a little bit of toasted sesame oil, and I put that on there. If I take that food item and I throw it in the earth, it decomposes into compost and it creates new life.
Mm-hmm.
If you take like some kind of packaged food product and you throw it into the earth, chances are it won't do that, you know? So that's what living food is. It creates life. So living food is when food is starting to germinate. So in raw food, we like to soak our nuts and seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that because it starts to grow the plant. And then we eat that, and that's called living. So that's a difference. Like a nut or seed that's just dried and dormant, that is raw because it hasn't been heated or manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you soak it, it's starting to germinate. If you were to throw that in the soil, it would actually grow a plant or sprout or a tree. That's live food. So it's a slight distinction there, but people use that interchangeably, raw and living food.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another category. Oh, superfoods.
Superfoods.
So superfood, you know, the FDA has its own definition of superfoods. The FDA calls fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds superfoods in and of themselves because nuts and seeds are high in antioxidants. They're high in things like vitamin E. Vitamin E builds the collagen in our skin. Mm-hmm. It fights free radical damage. It slows down signs of aging. So any nuts or seeds that we eat, great for our brain, great for all of that stuff, nutrients. Fruits and vegetables are also very high in vitamins and minerals and also in antioxidants as well. So all the same things, vitamins. So instead of taking like a supplement, and if you think about what I was saying before, a supplement is manufactured in a factory. It's made into some kind of dormant state on its own. It's packaged on this big machine, and then it's put into some kind of plastic bottle where it sits for years, shipped around the country, you know. So I'd rather get supplements from the earth straight from my food. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's why I think the FDA calls fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds superfoods anyway, because it's like eating supplements and vitamins. There's another category above that of superfoods where we've identified plants where they have like superpowers. So the maca is a root of a plant in Peru. And so in the Andes, the elevation is so high mm-hmm. that they eat this to help strengthen their adrenal glands and make them stronger so they can climb up and down that elevation. And so unlike caffeine, when we drink coffee when we're tired, we're actually depleting our adrenal glands. And so we trick our body into thinking that we have more energy than we actually do when we're already tired. So our body is already running low on energy, our battery, but then we boost it on artificial energy and then run the battery even down even more mm-hmm. when it already has no energy. Maca, on the other hand, has become very popular over the last several years with athletes because it's actually strengthening our adrenal glands. In turn, it gives us more energy because we are becoming more vital, because we are becoming stronger. And then it boosts our energy levels that way. It's also been used as to help with hormone replacement stuff for mm-hmm. postmenopause. Mm-hmm. So it's really great for balancing our whole endocrine system. And then also for men, it's sort of known in Peru and in the Andes as being a natural Viagra because it just builds our vitality is what mm-hmm. it's doing. Mm-hmm. So that's like a superfood. So things like spirulina, chlorella, those are blue-green algaes. Same thing, it's a plant. It's an algae that grows in the water, but it has, you know, really potent powers. It's so strong because it has a lot of chlorophyll. It's great for detoxing heavy metals. We're worried about mercury in our water. Mm-hmm. You know, with like the awful tragedy in the Gulf and all that. So, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then also with radiation coming from Japan, a great right. way. I mean, you know, as soon as that happened, people rushed to the pharmacy to buy what? To buy iodine. Well, the great source of iodine naturally is sea vegetables. Mm-hmm. So nori, you know, nori and sea vegetables are becoming more familiar through Japanese restaurants. So you go to a sushi restaurant, all those rolls, the black thing on the outside mm-hmm. is nori. It's a plant that grows in the ocean. So same thing, it's a plant. Mm-hmm. And so that is a great source of iodine. So it comes in many different plant forms from, you know, nori to arame to hijiki. It's just different types of sea plants.
But that was the other thing that kind of raised my stress level as I was reading your book. It's like, now I've got to learn all of these new terms about all of these new plants and vegetables that I've never heard of. Some of them I'm familiar with. I think most of us are familiar with what nori is and seaweed and sea kelp and that kind of thing. But there are a couple of things that I really like to explore a little bit further here. One of them being that as I was reading your book and coming across these terms, and then I started to look up raw foods, I read that in order to get the full benefit of eating raw, you have to eat foods in certain combinations or in certain orders or over a certain period of time, et cetera. Do you subscribe to that? And why do we have to regulate our eating in that way in order to get the benefit from the food?
See, I never regulate my eating. I just eat whatever. So, again, that is another level of stress. If somebody has digestive challenge or has a health challenge mm-hmm. and we want to decrease the amount of stress we're putting on the digestive system, then it absolutely makes sense. So that's on the extreme side. Or somebody has a sensitive digestive system at first that they can't deal. So the idea basically is that certain foods break down faster. Something like a watermelon or a cantaloupe, mm-hmm. you can imagine it's a lot of water, it's sugar. Yeah. That'll digest in about 10, 20 minutes. Something like a nut, like an almond, may take 2 hours to digest because it's heavier, it's denser, it's a protein, it has a lot of fat. So if we think about the cantaloupe as being like a Ferrari, and we think about the nut as being like a big semi-truck, you know, and they're on a one-lane freeway. You don't want the Ferrari to get stuck behind the the truck, mm-hmm. you know? So that's,
oh, that's
the idea.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, okay. So if the Ferrari is stuck behind the truck, what happens is that it starts to break down. So the fruit will start to digest, but it's stuck behind
this.
It
has nowhere to go.
It has nowhere to go.
Right.
So what happens when fruit digests? It's sugar. So it starts to ferment. And that's why we then may get bloating and get gassy, because it's actually fermenting and it should be passing through, mm-hmm. but it's actually being trapped behind. Now, I think most people probably aren't sensitive to that kind of stuff. I'm not really sensitive to that. But if somebody is having a health challenge, you don't want to be stressing out the body to that level. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm trying to appeal to I just want to encourage people. Basically, my recipes, the way I think about it, is just composed salads. So it's just a way to inspire people to have more whole food mm-hmm. in whatever diet. So, you know.
Yeah, but you also just spoke about, you know, if people have some digestive issues. And I can tell you that as people age, things work differently mm-hmm. in your body.
Yeah.
And I know that I'll just use my family as an example. My mother she can eat tomatoes, and I can't remember which order. She can either eat raw tomatoes and not cooked tomatoes, or cooked tomatoes and not raw tomatoes. I love apples, and one of the things that I make all the time if I want to give a gift is an apple tart. Mm-hmm. I can't eat apple skins. Apple skins, for some reason, just cause me to burp unmercifully. And yet, I can eat a baked apple with no problem mm-hmm. at all. I love all kinds of fruits and vegetables, but pineapple cuts up my mouth something fierce.
There's a lot of enzymes in pineapple.
Yeah, and it just really cuts me up. So there is a way to look at foods, even raw foods. That means you have to be a little bit careful about what you do and how you do, and you've got to listen to the biofeedback of your
Absolutely.
Own body.
Absolutely.
You know,
you
you can't just jump head first into this and just start eating raw foods. I think you've got to test some things out, don't you?
We already eat a lot of raw foods. So we already eat salsa, guacamole. In the summer, we already have gazpacho. Everyone knows what a green salad is. That's mm-hmm. all it is. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, but you know, it's, again, I'll use my family as an example. My mother can't eat iceberg or romaine, but she can eat a butter lettuce. And that was a process that happened over time. I don't know if it's because she aged and or if she had some illnesses or something like that. So when I say you can't just go jump directly into it and go headstrong into it, I think you've got to kind of test the waters a little bit, maybe with one meal a day. Maybe you're going to do lunch. And every day at lunch, maybe you're going to do this whole raw foods and then listen for what your body is telling you about.
Yeah, I think you're coming from the approach of all or nothing. And I never mm-hmm. advise all or nothing. Mm-hmm. So when I work with people that want to simply include more whole, fresh ingredients mm-hmm. into any diet, which is what I encourage, I say you can do that easily by adding a protein shake to any breakfast. So the way I think about that is if somebody's making eggs and bacon, mm-hmm. I say, great, make your eggs and bacon. I'll be over here with my blender making a big, beautiful protein shake that has some fruit in it, maybe some blueberries, some hemp protein, whatever, and I make a shake. I have them drink that first, and it's at least a pint. So what's happening is they're filling up on the water and the fiber, all the nutrients. Then they may eat only 3/4 or a half of their eggs and bacon. You know, I'm not saying don't eat your eggs and bacon. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying include more whole foods. We all know that the more whole foods we eat, it's just better for us. More mm-hmm. vitamins and minerals and nutrients. At lunch, an easy way to do that, again, a shake, like a chocolate milkshake. My chocolate milkshake is made out of cashews and raw chocolate powder. It's delicious, sweetened with a date, which is a fruit. So it has no refined sugar. It has no dairy for people who are lactose intolerant. It's just a delicious shake. Mm-hmm. So you're having a milkshake. You can have that with your burger and fries. That same thing's going to happen. It's going to fill you up, so you may eat less of your burger and fries. What I also encourage people to do is add a green salad. A green salad is something that's familiar to everyone. Mm-hmm. So if you can't eat, you know, if you can only eat butter lettuce, you can't eat iceberg, choose your favorite lettuces. Mm-hmm. Make a delicious dressing, make a great, you know, salad, have that. Another great way to add on whole foods to any diet, no matter what the meal is through a raw dessert. The way that I make one of my most famous recipes is a chocolate raspberry fudge ganache cake. Mm-hmm. And it has a flourless cake texture. The way that I make it is that in a food processor, it takes like 5 minutes, literally. In a food processor, you put walnuts. You grind that down into a powder. and then it's like a powder. So then you put cocoa powder in there. And then the way you bind it is with sticky dates. So dates, again, whole fruit. It's not a refined sugar. It's sticky. So you put in that. And then you process it, and it binds it all together. So that texture is like a flourless chocolate cake texture. Mm-hmm. It's like a brownie. And then the way I make my frosting is I take an avocado, which is a heart-healthy fat. You whip that. It makes a beautiful light cream. Mm-hmm. You put cacao powder in there. You put sweetener in there, whether it's agave or date again, or you can use maple syrup or honey, whatever you want. And then you make a chocolate frosting. Mm-hmm. So that's so delicious, right? It has a mouthfeel of real fluffy frosting. And then I shape the cakes. I make put fresh raspberry layers in between layers of cake, and then I frost it. Mm-hmm. And that's a cake. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. delicious does that sound? So you yeah, add so that
it
on.
Sounds great. And I have to attest that you did bring in some
kale chips.
Kale chips. And the kale chips are fabulously delicious. Yes, I have to admit that they are fabulously delicious, and I will be using that recipe.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make salads less boring, right? Yeah. Because there's this image of, oh, salads are boring. But they don't need to be boring. We just combine vegetables in a new, interesting way, cut vegetables that are familiar in new shapes, combine them in new ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to inspire people to eat more fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds.
Well, yeah, you talk about combining vegetables in an interesting new way. And one of the things that really gave me a tickle when I was reading your book is I find rice very ubiquitous in every kind of Asian cuisine that I've ever eaten. And so I wanted to see, okay, so does she eat rice? And then I saw the rice recipes, and I started to really laugh because you make your own rice.
I do. It's funny. I don't like rice. It's so funny. I'm Asian. I just don't like rice.
Well,
I don't know why.
I'm not Asian, and I can hardly eat a meal without rice. I have a Japanese friend who told me in very broken English, she said, I think you Indonesia. Oh. Because I eat so much rice. So why don't you tell our listeners about what Annie's rice is like? How do we make Annie's rice?
Well, I make rice in lots of different ways. I think that one of the recipes in Annie's Raw Food Asia uses cashews. So again, mm-hmm. if you put cashews into a food processor and process it down, it chops it into little bits, and cashews are white. So it sort of mimics the look of a rice mm-hmm. dish. I can also add in a little bit of jicama, because jicama is also white like that. I've also made it with cauliflower. I take cauliflower, put it into a food processor, break it into little pieces. And so anything that's white, you know, when it's that small, and then you can season it. Like I'll make like, in the past, I mix it basically with a salsa. And that's mm-hmm. how I make like a Mexican rice, you mm-hmm. know, with like some cilantro and stuff, and use it in the same way. So in Asia, I make it like a drier version. So that's why I'm using the cashews. And then you can put it on top of a nori sheet the same way that you would a cooked rice. It's less sticky though. So you'd want to put an avocado in, which has that binding property. Mm-hmm. So that would help stick it all together. But that way it's just cutting out a lot of the carbs, a lot of the gluten. Some people have gluten issues, and it's just much easier to digest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you are accustomed to eating rice that has a little bit of texture to it, because I personally like sticky rice, is there a way for you to get that by making rice in the way that you were just describing?
The rice that I make doesn't have that stickiness because there's mm-hmm. no gluten. It's the gluten that makes it sticky. However, I do make a mochi wrap. So in order to make mochi, they use sticky rice, which mm-hmm. is a short grain sticky rice. And so I actually make a wrap out of coconut meat. So I'll take a Thai baby coconut, scrape out the coconut meat, blend it into a puree, and then I'll spread it onto a dehydrator sheet and dry it for a few hours. And then I'll do things like make an ice cream out of cashew milk instead of dairy milk. Mm-hmm. You know, today it's common to see hemp ice cream, coconut ice cream. So I might take a coconut ice cream or a cashew ice cream, and then I'll roll it in that wrapper. And then I'll slice it and then serve it. And as it's melting, it has very much a similar mouthfeel to mochi, you know, like mm-hmm, the mochi mm-hmm, ice cream balls. Mm-hmm. So that's
yeah,
how I make
I love
the mochi.
Mochi. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I find raw food so interesting. It's really like alchemy, because when I'm developing these recipes, I'm really focusing on the flavor profile, really understanding in the cooked version what are the flavors, the spices, the herbs, but just as importantly, it's the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. So if I'm trying to get like a mochi sticky rice mouthfeel, since I'm not using sticky rice and I'm not using gluten, what can I use and what can I do to that, like dehydrated or slices a certain way to really mimic a certain mouthfeel? Mm-hmm. So another really great ingredient that I use for mouthfeel is carrot pulp. So if you think about carrot pulp that's left over mm-hmm. after juicing carrots, it has a flakiness that's sort of similar to like a salmon. You know? So when I make, if you stretch your mind to imagine, I'll make a mayonnaise out of nuts again. So maybe cashews, a little bit of lemon juice. And then I'll make like a sauce. And then I'll put the carrot pulp in there and mix it up. And then the same way I dress a tuna salad, I might put some celery, might put some onion, might put some parsley, might put some black pepper. So you can see how the mouthfeel would be very similar to an actual tuna fish salad, but it's actually made with carrot pulp, so there's no fish in there, and it has a similar flavor profile. So that's why it's so fun for me to develop raw food recipes. I think it's like a real alchemy. It's a little different.
Yeah. Well, you had to put a lot of thought and a lot of energy into, since you're a cookbook author, creating these recipes. When did you know that you had something unique? That you needed to commit to paper to be able to share with other people? Did it come through your catering? Did it come through friends? Or was there just a moment when you realized, you know, if I can sell the rest of the world on this, there may be something in it, not only for me, but for all of the people that I come into contact with? What was the moment and how did you go about it?
Like I said, I used to live in Portland for 4 years, and I used to travel quite frequently up to the U District Whole Foods in Seattle and also in Bellevue, where I would teach classes, like at least once a month at each of them. And then I do workshops, and I did catering and events and all of that. And in all of that, people would always say to me, we just want your recipes. When is your book going to come out? And I'd always say, I'm writing it. And they'd say, we don't need you to write it. We just need a compilation of your recipes. So just make a book. So actually, my very first book was self-published. It was called The Art of Raw. And it was a spiral bound, had 50 recipes. But it was just everyone just kept asking me for recipes. And so that's what inspired that. And then my publisher actually found me online. And I had small distribution of that little self-made little cookbook. And one of the places was San Francisco Whole Foods was carrying it. And the publisher was in Berkeley. So I was able to send them there and they were able to see it. And that's what those 50 recipes went into my first book, Annie's Raw Food Kitchen, which actually had like 150 or 175 recipes. So I think it was just people asking. But really, the thing that really turned me on to raw food in general, I think, is that it's really amazing. But the first time I ever had a gourmet raw food dinner was in the mid-90s, and it was in San Francisco. My job in the 90s for about 8-9 years was .com 1.0 web. So I was an internet designer and an interaction designer, and it was a very exciting time. And at one point, I literally was working a full-time job during the day at a design studio. I was consulting full-time for a studio in LA. I was consulting on maybe two or three projects on the side. I was teaching at university. I taught at Berkeley. I taught at San Francisco State University and also San Jose State University. So I would teach class at least Tuesday, Thursday every week. Plus, I teach workshops on the weekend. I'm talking like 100, 120 hour weeks.
Yeah, you're talking about two people.
Literally, or three, right? So I purposely was not sleeping maybe one night a week because it was a very exciting time. There's all these emerging technologies, and I knew all this crazy Web 1.0 craziness wouldn't last forever, and it was so fun, all these new opportunities and stuff. And so when I first had my first gourmet raw meal, it was dinner, and I could not sleep all night long. I had a presentation at 9 in the morning the next day, and so I planned after dinner to go and work. I had so much mental clarity, and I could focus so clearly, and I could create this amazing PowerPoint presentation. I just cranked through it. I actually stayed up all night, perfected my presentation, the whole time thinking, okay, after my 9 o'clock presentation, I'll just go home and take a nap. 9 o'clock rolls around. I felt fine. You know, it was amazing.
And you gave credit to that one meal, you think?
Yeah. Because if you think about it, after a Thanksgiving meal, why do we feel tired and bogged down?
Tryptophan.
Yeah, yeah, but also a lot of the starches, a lot of the carbs. If we think about, I mean, I love bread, so don't get me wrong on this one, but if we think about flour as a child, we used to make paper mache, which is paste. So it's flour and water. So if we put that into our body, it's just putting, our digestive system just has to work a lot to get that sticky stuff through our whole system. Right. So instead, if we're eating fruits and nuts and vegetables, things that are lighter, the body just doesn't have to expend as much energy to digest. So it's actually left over with more energy.
Do you remember that meal?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it smelt so vibrant. Because, you know, having been raised the way I was, I was fed that food more for functional reasons. This was the first time I was given that food for gourmet. And it took me years. Years later, my mom connected it back and was like, oh, do you realize that's how we raised you? It took years. At first, I didn't realize that that was how I was raised.
But you did realize that it was familiar, though, right? When you were having the meal.
Yeah,
there was something about it that was familiar.
It was so fresh and so whole. But I had so much energy. And that's when it really clicked. I was like, oh my goodness, what was in that food? I need to learn more about it. And then I had this idea of like, food should be fuel for our body. So after I eat, I should feel more energized. I shouldn't feel tired. The food shouldn't take from me. It should nutrify me and give me more energy. It should fuel me up. And that's when that awareness really happened. And so then, of course, immediately I started like going to the restaurant. I'm like, how can I learn more about this? How did you make it? Can I take classes? And I started making more of the food for myself. And everywhere I'd go, I'd sort of take it with me. Hey, try this, because I felt so great. Of course, you want to share that with everyone. Try drinking this. Try eating this. And the desserts, you know, any potluck I would go to, I'd make desserts because people wouldn't even think that it's not cooked. You put it on the table with all the other foods, they're like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And they just eat it. And then they'd ask me, how'd you make that? And then they're like, but how did you cook it? Did you bake it? And I'm like, no, actually, you just assemble it and that's it. No baking. And then it would click. Oh my God, it's a no bake. You didn't cook it, you know? But it was just delicious. So people just started asking me then, when you come, can you make this? And then people just started ordering stuff from me. And then that's when I realized, wow, okay, I think there's a real demand for this and there's no supply. Like, nobody's supplying this. Right. And so I started doing the events on the weekends. And we'd get like 50 to 100 people at an event, you know, at a dinner. That's a lot.
That's a lot of people. Yeah,
and I was really just doing it as a service because I had a day job. You know, I worked in the corporate world. And it was really so that when I would make food for the weekends, that means I had food several days up to that because, you know, I'd be preparing food for that event. And then after the event for several days, I'd have the leftovers. So it was really for selfish reasons that I was making this food and then sharing it with everyone because I'd never just make that level of food for myself because it was really high-end gourmet. And then that's one day I just realized after realizing that these corporations, the one that I was working in particular at that time, was not recycling all that paper. They were not recycling. So the water cups in the break room were styrofoam 4-ounce or 6-ounce little cups. So people would take one shot of water, throw away the styrofoam cup. Okay, it was killing me. And then it was in Southern California during the rolling blackout time. So we were having an energy shortage. So they were doing rolling blackouts. But yet this building, which is a skyscraper, it was one of the networks. It was so ice cold that in the dead of summer, people would be bringing blankets and coats and wearing them at their desk. We couldn't even type because our fingers were frozen. And I realized, gosh, they're wasting this much energy. They're not really doing that much to give back to community. They're sort of creating negative role models for young kids, and they're not recycling. So what am I doing making this company more money? You know, where I have this sort of business on the side on the weekends that's actually helping people feel good. They're getting healthier. You know, this food helps you lose weight, slows down signs of aging, boosts your immune system, makes you feel better, which then makes you happier, which then means you live longer and live a better life. So and you're also treading very lightly on the planet, doing something good for the earth. And so that's when I made that shift. And I was like, you know, I think I have something here. And I think I'm going to quit my day job and really focus 100% on this raw food business.
So is that why, let me preface this question by saying that as I was reading your book, I was a little surprised when I would run across recipes for household products or recipes for personal care products. And then there's a whole series of smaller pieces that are integrated in the book that just talk about living a better lifestyle. Is that why that's a part of this book, and are all of your books written that way?
Absolutely.
Where your philosophy is throughout the book in addition to the recipes?
Yeah, because it's a lifestyle. It's not just a diet.
Yeah,
it's not
it
just
is.
Recipes. Because I'm encouraging people to eat locally and seasonally. And I mean, by making these choices,
you have to make serious commitments. I must say, you have to make serious commitment. Once you get into it, there are a couple of things that hit me right off the bat. Is that, wow, this is a serious expanse of energy on the startup, because you have to have to be educated about some things. You can't, like I said previously, you can't just jump in and go start buying carrots and broccoli or sprouting your own beans. You really have to learn a little bit about it. Then it seems to me that this is a little bit of an expensive way to live, too. And so you have to have the funds to be able to commit to fully organic and range-fed and eating locally and there's a little bit of an outlay both of time and resources in doing this.
So that's exactly the misnomer I'm trying to to clear up. So for me, I actually spend about $20. Again, I'm not buying the meats, but I buy mostly greens. And when I go to the farmer's market, I spend about $20 for my entire week. Because if you think about a head of organic green, it might be a dollar or two. That head of organic green is going to make salad for like 2 days. You know, so fruits are a little bit more expensive. An apple is maybe 70 cents or a dollar organic. But again, what I was talking about earlier, I'd rather spend a dollar on a fruit or a vegetable than on printing, labeling, packaging, distribution, gasoline, warehousing, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I actually believe that we're getting more for our money. Also, it's preventative care. Mm-hmm. So even there may be this perception that in the front, it costs more money. But I think it's sort of...
Well, it's money and time. Because like I said, there, again, you know, as I was reading this, it was like, okay, I need to learn some stuff here. And then, like I said, you were talking about ingredients that are not fully familiar to me.
It's
so,
because the Asian cookbook.
Well, but, that's true, too.
My previous cookbook called Annie's Raw Food Essentials, that's mm-hmm. exactly it. It's sort of like hand-holding the reader to set up their kitchen. And I know that takes a little bit of energy. So all... What I tell everyone, all we really need is a food processor and a blender.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
And
then
dehydrator.
You just start. You don't really need a dehydrator. That's like a luxury nice to have, mm-hmm. but I actually don't really personally use a dehydrator mm-hmm. that much. When people are transitioning, they like to make like breads and things like mm-hmm. that, so it may help. And then there's lower end dehydrators that start at like $40. They're the stackable round ones mm-hmm. that you can get at like a kitchen store or whatever. But I really want to sort of show that there isn't that much barrier, because like a blender you can get for $10 or $20, a food processor maybe $20. And all those things are doing, like a food processor, is making hand chopping faster. And so
let me say this, though. You're also talking about highly perishable food products. And so when you go and you're buying a week's worth of food from the farmer's market, you better be prepared to deal with it and deal with it very
fresh
rapidly.
Food.
It is fresh, but it's not going to stay fresh for an entire week is what I'm getting at. So while you have a week's worth of greens, in the first 2 days, you've got to do something with that week's worth of greens, because then they're going to start to deteriorate rather rapidly.
I think it depends on what kind of greens you get. I actually like things like chards and kales. I love cabbages. Mm-hmm. And those things will actually surprisingly last like a couple weeks maybe, because they're coming. So if we think about, again, things that we get at the store,
mm-hmm.
that's been picked. A lot of times it may be picked unripe so that it can ripen in transit. So it's picked, it's containered, it's sent to the warehouse. From the warehouse, it then goes out to the store, it sits there. When you go to a farmer's market, it's usually picked at like 4 or 5 in the morning, a few mm-hmm. hours before. So there's actually a lot more time we get. That what we get from the farmer's market lasts probably like a week longer mm-hmm. than what we get from the grocery store. That's mm-hmm. why I love farmer's markets. I feel like we get more.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, there's ways, if we want things that last longer, you know, cabbages last couple weeks, you know, kales, chards. Those, I actually like those hardier kinds of vegetables. Things that are more delicate, like a butter lettuce or a spring mix. Yeah, sure. That might last. If you buy it from a store, it lasts a couple days. If you buy it from a farmer's market, it'll last at least 5-6 days, maybe even a week.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how you store it and all that kind of stuff. But it's just a shift in, yeah, like you said, priorities. And, you know, some people might think, oh, this food is more expensive, or, it may take a lot of time, but really, that's why I'm saying, if you have a food processor or blender, I design my recipes so that each recipe only has like a handful of ingredients. You just throw it in a food processor or a blender and you just blend. It takes a couple seconds. And then the cleanup is so easy. You just rinse. A lot of times you don't even have to use a sponge or water. You can just rinse it off mm-hmm. and it's fine. So it's faster cleanup. Nothing's like caked on, stuck on, baked on. You don't have to soak anything. So I actually find it's a shift in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
but once you set up your kitchen that way, it's actually much faster and easier, and it can be much more economic. If you're using a lot of like the expensive superfoods, which I actually don't think is really necessary, like we're talking about maca, but you can do like a teaspoon or a half a teaspoon a day. You know, a bag is going to last you months, you know?
Well, so, yeah, that's true. Especially if you're buying bulk, which I do
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Yeah, it's good for the environment to buy
right,
bulk.
Right.
Less packaging.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
And it's entirely a lot cheaper because you don't have all of that
Packaging
and other stuff that goes
labeling,
along with
printing,
it.
Labeling,
yeah,
printing.
Yeah, I can get all of my spices. Whenever I buy herbs and spices, I never pay more than $1 for it.
Exactly.
Because I just get it in a little bag and I get a tablespoonful at a time or whatever it is that I need, and I can use up within the month. I like to use up all of my herbs and spices extremely quickly.
And I put those all into glass jars, and I just have all these glass jars stacked up. Yeah, so once you have all that stuff and you're all set up, if you have your herbs and spices and you just have a couple different nuts and seeds, I don't even personally eat that many nuts and seeds because I'm watching like the fat in that. And then you might have, actually, sea vegetables are very economical. You can get like a pack of like 50 nori sheets for like $3 or $4 at the Asian store. You know, so, and then if you get like a bag of wakame, the dehydrated wakame, you hydrate that. It grows to like three or four times the size. It's a great travel food, too. Yeah. And again, it helps with the radiation from airplanes. When you get to the other side, you can eat sea vegetables. It can be very economical. It doesn't need to be. Like, if you're eating tons of nuts and superfoods, it could be expensive, but it doesn't need to be. And so I'm really trying to break that misconception to show that it is very easy, very accessible. It can be very economical. And it's also investing in our health to avoid even more expense down the line. For imagine how much money spent when someone does get sick. That's really expensive. You know,
I noticed, too, that you make your own milk, which you spell M-Y-L-K, because there's no dairy in it. And you make that from seeds and nuts. And when I think about milk, I think about milk as a breakfast item. And so is there a breakfast option for like cereal with milk?
Absolutely. A really easy way to make, well, let's see, there's lots of different cereals. So for like a dry cereal, what I'll do is basically take a trail mix, and that'll be my cereal. So I'll make a little mix of like maybe sunflower seeds, which have less fat, maybe some buckwheat groats that have been sprouted, and then maybe some pecans because of the flavor. And then I might put some dried cranberries and raisins, maybe put some sesame seeds or something like that, and then pour some milk on there. And then what I'll do too is maybe slice some fruit and put it on there, like apples, and that's how I'll make like a granola, muesli type of cereal. What I might also do is take oat groats, which are oats that have not been processed, and then you just soak that overnight, and you put that soaked oat groat into your food processor with like a banana or a couple dates, and you process that, it makes oatmeal. It's so fast and easy. You can just imagine, you just soak it overnight, you just put it into your food processor, put a banana for natural sweetener, process it, and then you can pour the milk over that. So for the example with the milk, that is so economical because you can go to any store. They have almond milk, they have hemp milk, right? They have all these different kinds of boxed milks. How much are they? They're like $3, $3.50. Well, imagine you can get like a pound of nuts for like, you know, if they're organic, let's say cashews, maybe $10 or something.
Right.
You'll use like a handful, which is maybe like a not even a quarter cup. You can put it into your blender with a few cups of water and just blend it. That's all you do, and that's cashew milk. You're making the same volume as that box of milk, but it literally costs you like, I don't know, pennies. And it might take more time, but does it really? I mean, to go to the grocery store, to go down the aisle, to read the boxes, to pick the box, put in your thing, go wait in that long checkout line to check out. And does it really take longer?
Do you strain it or do you just use it?
I don't strain it. Some people, if they don't like the particles, they will strain it. But I actually like that sentiment. And so somebody described it like this the other day. They said that that sentiment sort of reminds them of what's left over after a bowl of cereal.
Right.
You know, so And so I like that because that's the fiber. So I like that. But if somebody doesn't like that, you can easily just strain it through a sieve or through a filtration bag. So it's very easy to take that out. But yeah, so it's so easy. So there's an example where it might take literally like 10 seconds to make it. And then the cleanup is you just rinse out the blender container. That's it. So I actually think in that instance, it's actually faster than going and buying a box of boxed almond milk.
I was reading your book forced me to go and take a look at some of the science around raw food. And there are some scientists who say that some of the food, the nutrients in foods, is not nearly as bioavailable raw as it is cooked. And they
like
specifically
lycopene.
Point out some of the carotenoids, beta-carotene, lycopene, et cetera. They say that the nutrient value of it goes up 30% when it's cooked because it has to break down the cell wall in order for your body to actually get the benefit of that. The other thing is that I've just in the last year started mushrooming. All of my listeners have heard me talking about going mushrooming. And I never go without an expert. And all of the experts caution that any mushroom, even the ones that you buy in the grocery store, that are that little ubiquitous button mushroom everywhere, that you really should not eat it raw, that mushrooms have toxicity in them that needs to be cooked out, and some of them need to be cooked rather a while before actually that those toxic elements dissipate, morel mushrooms being one, which is what we hunted this past weekend. And yet, I didn't see those kinds of cautions in your book at all. Can you tell me what your thoughts are about that, or if you have a difference of opinion about that, et cetera?
Let's see. I haven't really looked into the mushroom thing so much. I think that maybe in marinating the mushrooms, I think that it's probably doing a similar thing as cooking it, because the way that I marinate my mushrooms is that I put a little bit of either salt or raw soy sauce, mm-hmm. and then a little bit of acid sometimes from like a lemon. Mm-hmm. And so the salt and the acid will break it down. So if you pour that over some sliced mushrooms and then set it aside, so I leave it to marinate. I make mm-hmm. a marinade like that. I may put a little bit of sesame oil in there. Mm-hmm. I'll set it aside for about 15 to 20 minutes. And what happens is it releases all of its water and it gets soft. And so in getting soft, it's the mouthfeel is very similar to a cooked mushroom. So mm-hmm. that's what I'm doing to it. So I wonder if in that process it's sort of doing a similar thing.
I don't know. But what I would recommend is that it's probably worth some looking into, because prior to me actually taking mushroom class, I mean, I really did my homework before I started foraging in the forest. And then I didn't bring home anything that I didn't take to the experts and have them take a look at. And they actually have a class, not even a class, that they do.
Yeah, so I will look into that. But honestly, I've been eating mushrooms my whole life, and I've been fine. So I'm sure there's sensitivities.
There are sensitivities. Yeah, there are some people that are a little bit more sensitive than others to it.
With everyone, I encourage everyone to do our own research. Mm-hmm. And you started off by saying a really valuable thing. We all have to just listen to what works for us. What works for me is not going to work for someone else. What worked for me last year doesn't work for me anymore. Mm-hmm. We change. It depends on our climate, our season, our lifestyle. So I encourage everyone. This is what works for me, and so I love to share it with people. And I encourage everyone to go and listen to, find people that have found things that work for them. Listen to them. Try it on yourself. See which pieces work for you and adapt it to actually create the perfect program that works for you. Because we are all so individual and so different. We really need to just take that time and find what works for us as mm-hmm. individuals. So I encourage everyone to do that.
Okay. I'm going to thank you very much for joining us here at the Evergreen Radio and Reading Services for the Blind and the print impaired. Annie is going to have to leave. She does have another engagement to go to, but I could sit and talk to you for hours.
So could I. So interesting.
Food is one of the things that I'm extremely interested in, and I'm moving in this direction. And so this has really been a very good gospel for me to sit and listen to for a while.
Thank you so much.
Everybody, you have a website. Can you give us your website address?
Sure. It's just my name. It's A-N-I-P as in Peter, H YO.com. I have a website blog. I also have a bunch of videos and actually cooking videos on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/ANIPHYO. And I'd love it if you kept in touch with me on Facebook, which is also facebook.com/ANI.PHYO.RAWFOOD.
Okay. Thank you so much, Annie. And please come and see us on your next trip
with
your next book the next time you're in the area.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
The preceding program was a production of the Evergreen Radio Reading Service, a part of the Washington Talking Book and Braille Library based in Seattle.